big news. Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
JT Bridges, Andrew Payne, thanks for joining me today on Think for Christ.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Well, a couple of weeks have now passed since the assassination of Charlie Kirk. A few days have passed since that 4+ hour marathon of a memorial service for him. And we've had some time now to watch as our culture, as our society has attempted to come to grips with this tragic event. So I thought that this would be a good moment for us to get together to reflect, both as Christians and as philosophers, on Charlie Kirk, on the assassination, and on the societal fallout from it all. I don't really have an agenda for us for our conversation today. I'm just really interested to hear your guys' thoughts on this. So to get us going, I'll start by expressing some of my own reflections, and then each of you can share your thoughts in turn. Well, over the last couple of weeks, I've, of course, been spending a lot of time thinking about Charlie Kirk, but I've also spent a good deal of time thinking about Socrates. And as it happens, I recently reread Plato's Apology for like the fifth time. And for those who may not know, the Apology is Plato's account of Socrates' trial before an Athenian court in 399 BC, where he's ultimately sentenced to death by hemlock. Now, naturally, I've been reflecting on the similarities that there are between the life and death of Socrates and the life and death of Charlie Kirk. And I think there are some discernible parallels here. For one thing, Charlie intentionally deployed the Socratic method of dialogue with his interlocutors on college campuses. But there are deeper similarities, I think. Like Socrates, Charlie's primary concern was for the state of the soul, the souls of the individuals that he interacted with, and the collective soul of the nation. So very much in the spirit of Socrates, Charlie wanted to direct people and direct society at large to the care for their souls and to the pursuit of virtue and justice. And like Socrates, Charlie challenged the political idols of his day. Socrates was very critical of the anthropomorphic depictions of the official state-sponsored pantheon of gods, famously. And this earned him, in the trial, the charge of atheism, which he, of course, vigorously denied. Charlie, too, was critical of the official state-sponsored woke dogma that's idolized in the American university, which earned him the false charge of hate speech or spreading hate. And most striking, I think, like Socrates, Charlie was accused of corrupting the youth. Because of his effectiveness, Socrates, as we know, was very popular with the young men of his time who would follow him around and even try to emulate what he did in conversation with others. And as we know, Charlie had a massive influence with the youth and especially with young men. Now, Socrates would ultimately be murdered because of his views about the gods or the god and because of his influence among the youth. And I think here we can see another formidable similarity. I would argue that Charlie too was ultimately murdered because of his beliefs about God and because of his effectiveness among the youth. And if I can mention one more point of continuity, like Socrates, Charlie was fearless and determined in the face of mortal danger. It's in the Apology that we find that famous declaration from Socrates that the unexamined life is not worth living. So Socrates was entirely unwilling to stop speaking the truth about the good, even if it meant his own death. At one point, he even tells the Athenian assembly that he must obey, quote, the god, even if it means disobeying the Athenian court. And Charlie, too, I think this has come out, was very much aware of the danger that he was in. He also refused to let fear stop him from speaking the truth about the good and from following the divine call that he saw on his own life. So I think there are a lot of parallels between the life and death of Socrates and the life and death of Charlie Kirk. And this makes, I think, Plato's apology extremely relevant to us today. And there's something that Socrates says during his trial in particular that my mind has kept returning to in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination. Socrates tells the Athenian assembly that if they vote to kill him, they won't be causing any real injury or damage to Socrates himself. Socrates didn't believe that the soul of a just man could be harmed. Rather, the ones who would actually suffer injury, the ones who would actually be damaged from the execution of Socrates, were the citizens of Athens itself. Socrates says that it's ultimately Athenian society that's going to suffer from his own death. And this because of what Socrates provided for the soul of Athens, it was irreplaceable. And here we have Socrates' wonderful accounting of what he considered to be his divine calling to Athenian society. Socrates says that he had been divinely commissioned by the god to rouse the people, to care for their souls, and by encouraging them to love wisdom, to pursue virtue. And it's here that Socrates provides his famous depiction of himself as the gadfly of Athens. Socrates saw himself as a fly, buzzing and biting and annoying and provoking the morally sluggish horse that was Athens. The god had according to Socrates' own telling, the god had gifted him to Athenian society to arouse them from their moral slumber and from their apathetic neglect of the soul. So Socrates explains that this is why he had spent his life in poverty, wandering around Athens, persuading and reproaching and cross-examining everyone who was willing to engage him. Socrates' whole purpose, that to which he dedicated his entire life, was to fulfill his divine commission from the god to awaken the people of Athens to care for their souls. Now, you guys can see where I'm going here. With the death of Charlie Kirk, I really believe that American society has lost a gadfly. Like Socrates, Charlie's entire life, since he was 18, has been dedicated to awakening and arousing the morally apathetic youth of this country. Charlie was willing to engage anyone who would listen so that he could persuade them to care for their souls, so that he could convince them to, like Socrates, pursue a life of wisdom and virtue, so that he could appeal to them to surrender, ultimately surrender their lives to Christ. So I didn't know Charlie personally, so I didn't feel any personal loss at his death. But over the last couple of weeks, I felt a deep loss for our country, because as with Socrates, Charlie's unique life and unique gifting really is irreplaceable. But if I could just, let me just end this monologue here, this comparison, on a positive note before I turn it over to you guys, because there is some hope at the end of the apology. After Socrates is sentenced to die, he gives a prophecy to the Athenian court that I think is worth reading. So let me read this. He says, quote, "I prophesy to you who are my murderers that immediately after my death, punishment far heavier than you have inflicted on me will surely await you. Me, you have killed because you wanted to escape the accuser and not to give an account of your lives. But that will not be as you suppose, far otherwise. For I say that there will be more accusers of you than there are now, accusers whom hitherto I have restrained. And as they are younger, they will be more severe with you, and you will be more offended at them. For if you think that by killing men, you can avoid the accuser censuring your lives, you're mistaken. That is not a way of escape which is either possible or honorable. The easiest and noblest way is not to be crushing others, but to be improving yourselves," end quote. And of course, in a way, I think Socrates' prophecy here was in fact fulfilled, for one of the young followers of Socrates that was present at his trial was none other than Plato, right? The philosopher Plato. And of course, from Plato came Aristotle. And together, these men did more to affect Western society than anyone else prior to the coming of Christ. So as I've reflected on all of this, kind of through the prism of Plato's apology, my hope and prayer has been that in the wake of Charlie's murder, others will rise up. Others will take his place and continue to call a nation to repentance, to call a nation to wisdom and to virtue. So that's the way my mind's been going, guys, since this tragedy. Like I said, it just happened to coincide with my rereading the apology again. So I can't help but make these parallels. So JT, let me turn it over to you for your reflections, and then we'll hear from Andrew.
Yeah, I was making some notes as you were going along, Anthony, just clarifying some of my own thoughts. I'll divide this into response as a Christian and then response as a philosopher. So the first thing is that I was spending some time in prayer, I think it was the day after Charlie got murdered, and just seeking some peace from the Lord, because it was unsettling, and it is unsettling. And something that occurred to me is this, that God and Charlie, God being the eternal one, knew from all of eternity that Charlie was going to be assassinated. This did not take God by surprise. And I found it encouraging that I think what God did for Charlie, because many people who know about his life know that he never went to college. And my niece actually, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, had an internship at Turning Point for a summer. She said that, you know, it was a big campus and there was a lot of people, but she said, you know, when you would see Charlie on campus, everyone would say, "Hey, Charlie," he would say, "Good morning, citizen." 'Cause of course he couldn't remember everybody's names. I thought it encouraging that it seemed like God, knowing that Charlie would be cut down before his 32nd birthday, put this fire and urgency into him. He didn't take 4 years off and go to an undergrad college, and he seemed to be hitting the ground running as a teenager, driven to build this organization to this national and international level. And so my pastor a few days later said, "You know, I think Charlie Kirk accomplished in 31 years more than most people accomplish in an entire lifetime." And I praised the Father for his providence and wisdom to give Charlie that kind of fire as a young man so that he could accomplish a lifetime's worth of goals in such a short time, knowing that he was going to be cut down. So it really strengthened my appreciation for the Father and his care and providence over us. The second thing is this response from this joyous response from I would say the demonically insane that are allowed to post on social media. You know, the Lord says that by their fruits you will know them, right? If you make a tree good, it'll bear good fruit. If you make a tree bad. So we can't see, just like we can't see the inner workings of a tree, but we can see the fruit that it bears. We don't see the inner workings of a person's heart. And it's telling that the reaction from among professed progressives was divided, that some progressives saw this absurd response and then left the Democratic Party over it, which means there's still people out there whose consciences have not been seared. But continuing in a theological reflective vein, it's this, and your your commentary on the apology reminded me of this, and that is we're called to be salt and light as Christians. And the analogy there is the difference between the sun and the moon. We're reflective light. We reflect God's truth back at the culture. And that's really what Charlie was doing. But what Jesus says in John 3 is that this is the verdict, that light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light, and they will not come into the light for fear that their evil deeds will be exposed, right? And so in even in the reflective light of a, not a perfect, but a good man who's bringing out the truth, the evil, as that darkness is dispelled, the evil can't hide. And so if it can't hide, it becomes enraged, it seems. So I think that is a, that's a point to be made. And then people ask, what should the Christian response be? Well, Jesus gave us certain responses. One is in Luke 12, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body and afterwards do nothing else. And as I was going over this passage with one of my friends, I said, this is, Jesus is not saying, if you die an accidental death, he says, do not be afraid of those who kill the body. He's talking about murderers, people that are actively trying to murder you, right? And so, and I understand the sentiment, but as a philosopher, and maybe this will be my segue, as a philosopher, I don't think we can turn off our sort of technical analysis when it comes to even pop culture, but I hear a lot of people on the Christian right saying, we need to be brave, we need to be courageous. And I understand what they're saying. But properly speaking, courage can only exist in where fear is possible, right? As a way of overcoming fear. And actually, the higher calling is fearlessness, right? It's not overcoming fear in order to accomplish our duty, which is kind of the nature of courage. It's actually a fearlessness. And that comes out of two things, a life of righteousness. And the other side of the coin of that is a life that has been where the flesh has been crucified, right? If we've counted ourselves dead to the world and its pleasures and its benefits, right? The world has nothing for me, right? I count myself dead to the world and alive to Christ. And then I live a righteous life. The righteous are as bold as lions, right? So I think the proper Christian response should be a kind of fearlessness where the mortification of the flesh and the life of righteousness give rise to a natural boldness that can be done in love without hints of, condemnation or self-righteousness, because that's God's way. There's also a sort of a man-made religious approach to it that can't be sort of filtered out of this self-righteousness or this condemnation, because it sees other people as our adversaries, when actually our adversary is God's adversary. It's Satan and his minions, right? These other people that are disagreeing with us today, we don't know of whom there will be some Saul to Paul conversions. I mean, Saul was breathing out murderous threats against the church, and then Jesus intervenes, right? So those are some of the sort of Christian reflections on the philosophy side of things. And going back to the, by their fruits, you will know them. I think one of the things that has been part of this political masquerade, if you will, that's my puppet show, hand gestures, is the illusion of a public square, right? The illusion that there still remains a public square where free dialogue can happen. And I say the illusion of it because I've been thinking about the three acts of the mind. Oops, sorry. I've been thinking about the three acts of the mind, conceptualization, existential judgment, and reasoning. And conceptualization is, and this is just pulling from Peter Crafe's Socratic logic. Conceptualization gives us terms, right? The terms that we use in our arguments, existential judgment is focused on the truth of reality, right? And so what do we see? What do we see that has raised so much, backlash? If you remember Matt Walsh's documentary, What is a Woman? That was so upsetting and provocative to the left, because all he was asking for is a clarification of a term and its conceptual basis, right? And just by asking for clarification of a term, he provoked sometimes hostile reactions and whatnot. So the second act of the mind, existential judgment, is it true? You know, you have some proposition. Is it true? Somebody said that the truth has become alt-right, right? The notion that that there is a fact of the matter. And in order to be good thinkers, we are beholden to try and suss out what that fact is, right? And then existential judgment, we satisfy ourselves that a belief is true, that is it, that the idea in the mind accords with reality. We satisfy ourselves largely in two ways, primarily with evidence, right? And secondarily with if not evidence that we directly possess, then evidence from a credible authority, right? The Crime Statistics Bureau or whatever, right? So, you know, how do you know this or how do you know that? If you don't have direct access to the evidence, the body of evidence, then you have to at least have access to some credible authority who does have direct access to the body of evidence and is trustworthy in terms of the way they handle that. So conceptualization that leads to terms, existential judgment that leads to our propositions, and then the logical structure itself, reasoning itself based on formal or informal fallacies. And then going back to the use of terms, fallacy seems to have become this word of, I don't like what you're saying. Right, it's lost this object. It itself has lost its objectivity of, you've made an invalid move in your inferences, or that you're informally doing something like an argumentum ad baculum or misericordium or something like that, or a genetic fallacy. Right. So my fear is that with this lack of it's a lack of valuing clear terms, true propositions, and logical reasoning. What is eroded is the rational public square. And then finally, this is my last philosophical reflection. I did a video on my channel a while back called "Why the Left Has Become Pathetic." And I was referring to Aristotle's rhetorical triangle, right? Logos, ethos, and pathos. Logos is the logic or the rationale of your argument. Ethos is the perceived credibility of the speaker. And then pathos is that emotional connection with the audience, for simplicity's sake. And what happens on the left is if they lack logos, if their arguments just don't make any sense, right? If they have lost credibility because of that, right? They cut videos together to give a very slanted propagandist perspective. So they lose credibility. What is left in terms of their rhetorical approach or their ability to persuade? It's simply the emotional connection with their audience. And that's what we've seen over the last 10 years or so, is this ratcheting up of the anger or the fear in order to move people to their perspective. And so those are the things that concern me as a philosopher looking at culture, and just this loss of not even the ability to reason, but the loss of the value of the individual components that make up a healthy life of the mind, right? I told my daughters today, my 16 and 14 year old, we were running errands. And I said, guys, I think by the time I'm in my 50s or 60s, I'll be one of the smartest guys on the planet. Just because you guys seem to be getting dumber by the day. And just the fact that, the fact that I've read, a couple thousand books in my day, and you guys have read not even like a handful, and I don't say that to praise myself. I say that as something concerning. It's like, is that there's this loss of, and then, I think I'm going to charge my 16-year-old every time I hear her say, I heard on TikTok.
Oh, jeez.
this ability to identify credible authorities on any given subject. It's like, this is just sort of very, very basic reasoning skills. So those are my thoughts.
I appreciate that. Thanks for those thoughts. There's some themes there that we can certainly return to. But Andrew, I want to give you some space just to walk us through your reflections.
Yeah, right out the gate, I do have to acknowledge that what JT is describing there at the end is essentially that movie Idiocracy, which is pretty daily. It seems like a prophetic movie. But that being said, one of the things about going last is most of the things you're planning on saying probably done already got said. So including actually Anthony, I was going to reference the apology, but you took that one, and very good job on that. I agree 100%. That was wonderful. But also I wanted to reference Immanuel Kant here, right? Because Immanuel Kant has an article called What is Enlightenment? And the article was written roughly around the time when the Enlightenment was really starting to grapple with itself as a political project. Right. Now, you could argue that it was always a political project, but particularly when it's becoming self-reflective in this time where sort of Kant gets everything going, it takes on a very much more directly and sort of precisely political sense. And in the opening of that article, he has a section where he outlines what it is to be a responsible person, essentially to be a person forming oneself into an enlightened state. And what he says essentially is, if I have a book to think for me, if I have a preacher to tell me what to do, if I have somebody else always that I can offload my my reasoning activity onto, then it's a much easier form of life. Definitely a much easier form of life. But I will never be an enlightened person. I will never achieve the kind of natural state that I need to have. And then at the end, he has the sort of famous line where he says, are we in an age of enlightenment? And he says, no, we're in the age moving toward the age of enlightenment. We haven't reached the goal. We're moving toward the goal. And the thing about that is, I think essentially you and JT were both kind of hitting on this to a certain degree with what seems to have taken over. I think the main philosophical question that follows upon the assassination of Charlie Kirk is what has happened to the state of discourse in the country. There are so many symbolic things about it too. I mean, straight down to the point that he got shot in the throat, for crying out loud, the place where the words are formed, for discourse. And there's so much about that that from a philosophical standpoint, the question is, what's happened to discourse? So I've been compiling a number of articles that are, I'm trying to stay with reasonably recognizable mainstream sources. A lot of them are places like, Salon and Vox and, Vanity Fair and whatnot. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, wrote one in Vanity Fair. And then there's a couple of others that are worth mentioning. Like there's Mehdi Hassan, for example. I want to say he was in Vox. And the question, Anthony, you opened up by referencing Socrates, right? It's amazing how many of these articles talking about discourse as well recognize that there's something kind of Socratic. They inadvertently kind of give away that, yeah, there's obviously a kind of Socratic connection here, because they always open up by saying Charlie Kirk was no Socrates. Every single article that I have found has made exactly that point. They start off by arguing that he was no Socrates. And, on the surface, at least from a, prima facie kind of sense, right, he's all about debate in the public square. Right. That's the whole point. There's at least the overt sort of general link that's easy to make. And so you kind of want to step back and say, all right, I'll let you, I'll read the rest of the article. I'll see where you, you know, where you derive your argument or what your claim is to discredit him as a kind of Socrates. And so a couple of them, I believe it was, I think it was the Salon article said that he had destroyed discourse. There's a professor at Yale that I read. I forget what his name is actually off the top of my head. His last name was Kahn. I know that. But he said that Kirk had poisoned discourse. And so the argument always seemed to be that, yes, we want to still preserve the claim that we are pro-discourse. However, we are pro-discourse under certain conditions. And those conditions have been invalidated by the behavior or maybe by the Yale professor. I think it's Tariq Kahn, I want to say, at Yale, that he actually was sort of alleging that Kirk was sort of a puppet master behind the scenes, orchestrating some intimidation, threats of his kids and so forth. You know, that there's always this kind of an allegation that behind the scenes, there's something discrediting, something illegitimate. There's actually just a brute power move, you know, that's ultimately at work. And the funny thing about that is, to my mind, when I'm reading these, there's the three, what's the term? It's the three masters of suspicion. The term master of suspicion was coined in a book called Freud and Philosophy by Paul Ricoeur. And the three masters of suspicion are Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche. And essentially, in their own way, each one of them is saying that, yes, while on the surface, reason would be what we are saying is occurring, dialogue, discourse, that there's this kind of rational back and forth. The reality is that, in fact, deep down underneath, it's nothing but a power play, just a brute power play. And so by subverting reason like that, bringing it back to some kind of brute power play, we ultimately, what we're really just encountering is just two different tribes duking it out in sort of masked ways. And so that's another thing that ultimately showed up in all of these different articles that I'm referring, which is to say that they're all, particularly Mehdi Hasan is making the point that, you know, the mask is essentially slipped and it's just fascism that's coming out, you know, something along those lines. And so the point about tribal thought, though, that it's really just a brute power play masquerading as a kind of rational discourse, is that this is something that's been occurring for a very, very, very long time. And so the way out of it from all of these articles seems to be the encouragement of just offload your reasoning task to the experts. And then the experts will take it from there. And then the experts will actually, you know, they'll do all the reasoning for you. And I'm thinking as a, you know, not exactly a Kantian, but as somebody who definitely appreciates Kant's point there, you know, this is the opposite of enlightenment. This is the opposite of the kind of thing that would form a good, productive, functioning, proper citizen, at least in the high ideal of what the citizen should be. And back to the joke about like Kirk saying, hello, citizen, right? Like the idea as well is that we're forming, the task is forming citizens, forming subjects, and forming subjects that will be properly functioning and even thriving in a political discourse. Now, if everything ultimately, though, has been reduced to a kind of tribal thought, then we shouldn't be surprised to find what the postmodern and usually kind of extreme leftist type figures have been saying for a very long time. And here I want to argue, or not argue, but assert that just words matter. Right, the nature of what we say will, even if we kind of don't mean it, we might put it forth as a hyperbolic sense in the beginning. Discourse progresses always, and it always will reach the conclusion that maybe I didn't want to draw, but was present in the language the whole time. And there has been a long, long history of the call for revolution. And in fact, it's kind of an amusing thing that the leftists of, you know, the leftists of today in 15 years will be the reactionaries that the next set of leftists will be reacting against and saying, they were poisoned by the right the whole time. They weren't legitimate. They failed on some ground. And the turn that always seems to happen generation after generation after generation is that the earlier generation is said to have not actually been sufficiently revolutionary. They weren't willing to actually do what was necessary to get the job done. And then anytime somebody acts out, anytime an act of violence occurs, of course, the immediate, you know, leftist intellectuals on the scene will say, we didn't actually mean kill people, which creates then the grounds for the next generation to come along and say they were weak, they weren't serious, right? And you see this play out again and again and again. And I went to a very, very leftist conference earlier this year, where everybody was a default Marxist at the conference. Everybody's calling for revolution. And I heard several blunt statements where the goal now is just to acquire power and wield it, things like that. And the funny thing is, the sort of default assumption, again, is that to be legitimate now is to actually be the guy that no longer talks, but that takes action. But what does taking action mean? And I think we've even seen in the response to a number of, well, in sort of those articles that I was referring to that are sort of critiquing the possibility of discourse, essentially what they're saying is that discourse actually, since discourse ultimately is a mask, you know, that's been sort of protecting this fascist overtake, that what we really need to do is just something other than the mask. And so something other than just engaging with the mask. And so somebody like Ezra Klein came along, and Ezra Klein, I think, needs to be lauded a bit more by conservative media right now, because he was one of the few leftists that came out and he wrote a really great piece in the New York Times where he said Charlie Kirk was doing politics right. And of course, every single article that I was citing before critiqued precisely that. They said, no, in fact, he wasn't. But what did Klein actually argue in this? Well, Klein's point was actually, I think, it itself has a history in philosophy. I think you can point all the way back to at least Hegel's master and slave dialectic, for example. But what Ezra Klein was getting at was the idea that essentially you have two options. You can either shoot it out or you can talk it out, right? These are the two options that you have. You can either have violence or you can have open discussion. And so then when he says Charlie Kirk was doing it right, well, if you have those two options and then you got rid of one of them, there's only one inference to make. Now, I'm sure, I think we can know exactly what the left would say in response here. The left would say, no, we're not necessarily advocating, you know, violence per se. Not necessarily saying no either, but they'll say we're not necessarily advocating violence. That in fact, maybe something like Kirk's words were violence, you know, it was a mask for violence, you know, so we need to expose that. But ultimately, we can kind of see what's happening. If you're going to react to Klein's point the way that these leftists have been reacting, then I think what it is clear is that there's only one inference to be made, and that is that violence actually is the proper response to tribal thinking. Insofar as at the base there's tribal thinking, then in fact, actually tribal thinking isn't thinking. It's programming. It's default. It's unloading your view onto somebody else and saying, I'll do whatever he does. And that's ultimately what a soldier in the trenches does. Basically, he doesn't make the battle plan. He just carries it out. And so tribal thinking, I think we can basically put our finger on, that's kind of the problem at the moment. Discourse is, I don't think we can get away from it. Discourse has, in essence, I don't want to say it's died, because I don't want to say it can't be brought back, but it's not doing well at the very least. Yeah. And that the task is, I think, to probably get rid of this tribal underbelly. How? I don't know. But as a philosopher looking at it, we are having malformed citizens who are offloading their rights and their duties as citizens onto a thinking class, and not a thinking class, but a class of commanders. And then discourse suffers accordingly. So that's.
Yeah, that's really good. It occurs to me ties together something that you both have kind of gestured toward, but it's very difficult to have dialogue with a person when the very basic question of the nature of the real is not agreed upon, right? So, you know, there is a very classic tradition that says that there is a mind-independent reality, and truth is a matter of conformity of our minds, conformity of our thoughts with that mind-independent reality. And then there's another tradition of thought, Andrew, that you're talking about, this postmodern kind of thought that says that truth is just a vehicle, it's just a tool to exert our power and our will. And it's really, really hard to have conversations across these worldviews, because it becomes, as you said, JT, a matter of authority, right? But another thing that has been recurring to me is just this notion, this truth that I think we've seen come to bear, that ideas have consequences, right? And specifically, ideas and conceptions shape our perceptions of the good, right? And then what we perceive as good then induces our wills and our appetites toward action. And as good Aristotelians, right, we believe that all things are desired under the nature of the good, at least the perceived good, right? So we have this individual who somehow has come to believe that taking the life of Charlie Kirk in public was a good to be pursued, right? I mean, I don't think that this is just a maniac. This doesn't, and there's no need to mention the guy's name here, but the assassin, the shooter, he doesn't seem to me just to be someone who belongs in a psych ward. And even when you read some of his text messages and in conversations with his family that the authorities have had and released and all the information that we have, it seems that this action was ideologically driven. Okay, at least that's the way it looks right now. So the question that's been kind of in my mind is, what is the underlying ideology that would warp an individual's perception of the good and distort it in such a way that suddenly the idea of taking the life of a good man is itself a good to be pursued? And it seems to me that this guy was, he thought that what he was doing was a good. He thought that he was killing a fascist. He thought that he was doing something good for society. He thought that he was protecting a threatened group, be it the trans culture or the LGBTQ culture more broadly. But what he did, it seems like he thought he was doing something good for civilization, or at least a subgroup within civilization. So just to continue this philosophical reflection, what would you guys say are some of these underlying ideologies that are distorting our perceptions of the good so that something so obviously evil would seem to some people to be a good?
Yeah, I've got some notes that I jotted down that I think may tie a few of these things together. The first is that, first I want to say, Drew, thanks for your political philosophy background that it's really proximate to this kind of discussion. In that vein, I was reading an article about natural law, and one of the footnotes said that that every product of practical reasoning starts from something speculative. So I think what the left is trying to do is they're trying to fracture that natural connection, because what they're trying to say is that, no, we want to change with our rhetoric the truths that all these people believe, these young people believe, but we don't want them to act on the logical extension of those things. Because we never explicitly advocated for the logical extension of those things. We just tried to shift all of the truths that are preconditions to those actions. And they want to absolve themselves from the actions themselves. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I read an article a number of years ago titled, "I am a liberal professor and my liberal students scare me." And this was an article by an adjunct professor at the University of, I think, Chicago back in 2009, 2010, something like that. And he made the statement that, you know, even back then, I can't believe 2010 is way back then, 15 years ago. That's shocking to me. But he said that these students, they were unable to accept criticism. And he said, because they equate, I think this is getting at the question that you asked, Anthony, they equate personal offense with material harm.
Yeah.
Right? So their response to personal offense, which can be highly idiosyncratic, their response to personal offense is equated with material harm.
Yeah.
So now we paint a context where the liberal media is constantly trying to adjust the speculum, the truth beliefs, the theoretical claims, divorced from evidence and reality, in order to incite a hypersensitivity to offense, which is then equated with material harm, which the innate sense of justice demands.
That's right.
Some kind of response. And the last thing I have jotted down here is in Jill Sohn's, I can see it, in Jill Sohn's Unity of Philosophical Experience, he talks about the difference. He talks about Bonaventure, I think. But in the context, he's talking about God's sovereignty and man's free will. And Bonaventure says we should err on the side of God's sovereignty because that's more pious. And Jill Sohn's response is there's nothing pious about being wrong about God, right? And he makes a statement in there. He makes a statement in there that I found extremely clarifying. He says, because piety is not self-limiting, right? This sense of moral correctness and superiority is not self-limiting. So this is why when people say the left will eat itself, and Drew pointed out that the next generation of radicals will eat the previous generation of radicals, it's, at least on my analysis, it indicates that there's this strong thread of piety that is not, it has no external limitations. And so there was an article by that a kid wrote. He's 22, 23. A couple of years ago, he got red-pilled because he had just done a bunch of research on, and he's a liberal going to a school, I think University of Washington or something like that. And as a liberally minded, far left kind of politically student, he had done some research on sexual assaults on campus, right? And it was something like 10 or 12% of undergrad females had this sort of experience. So he's in a group of his peers, his friend group, and they were saying that like half, they just threw out this inflated number that was not supported by statistics, the data. And he said, well, it's actually closer to 10 to 12%. And he was ostracized from the group until he posted a public apology for not minimizing the effect of that reality on campuses, but just trying to clarify its scope. Let's see. Oh, and the final thing is this. I was listening to Cliff. I cannot pronounce his last name. He does the Campus Apology. Clenchy? Starts with a K. Anyway, so Cliff. He was asked and answering the question about Protestants versus Catholics versus Eastern Orthodox. And I was just sort of reflecting on that. And because his response is, well, it doesn't matter what group you belong to. It matters what you've done with Jesus. You know what? And I thought a clarifying way to say that is God will only judge us individually, not as groups. God doesn't judge groups, right? And that seems to be the inverse of the opinion on the left, that they seem to be unwilling or unable to contemplate individual responsibility, individual virtues, individual vice, individual guilt or innocence. And they almost demand to be treated as not as an individual, but just as a part of a group, which goes back to Drew's point. And it goes back to this point on tribalism. What did you say? Your tribalistic thinking is not thinking at all. I turned away from my mic there, but so I think it strikes at this idea that that if we move as a group, then anything that any one of us does wrong, that responsibility gets diffused over the population of that group. So it's not really my fault, or it's not really something evil I've done, you know, and then the group seems to sort of cover for that as well. So it's just this toxic, I think is the right word.
Well, I definitely have some thoughts on this, but Andrew, is there something
to say there? A couple of things, but one of the things that I think needs to also happen in terms of the return to discourse is we need to recognize that it's not inherent power, obviously enough. But part of what that involves, I think, is recognizing that discourse is actually an olive branch, that it's not mm-hmm. my attempt to dominate you. It is an olive branch being extended to you, right? It is, in fact, my saying, I won't dominate you. And it's not a brute power struggle where I will attempt to dominate you. But in fact, mm-hmm. I'm going to try to extend an olive branch to you and say, actually, instead of one of us just putting the boot on the neck of the other, let's talk this through. Yeah. And so just the very nature of the extension of discourse to the other is already the funny thing is, in those articles I'm citing, the phrase or the word dehumanization kept being thrown out, that Kirk held dehumanizing views and therefore they wouldn't debate him because he held dehumanizing views. And one of the things is, if you hold dehumanizing views, then you say, I don't think this person's worth talking to because, right. you know, they lack the faculty of the logos to be able to reason their way to their conclusion. And since they lack that, therefore they just must be dominated. We saw that, for example, quite That's literally in the actual yeah. racist rhetoric of the past. Right. Yeah. But in fact, by sort of a counter deal, if I'm going to say, you are worth talking to, then I'm saying, you have the logos, you have the same human capacity that I do, and maybe we can actually reach a resolution peacefully this way. And the funny thing is, Anthony, you were reading The Apology. I was just reading Plato's Republic. And the famous opening of The Republic has the encounter with Thrasymachus. And I double and triple underlined how that gets resolved, because it dawned on me about, maybe about almost at the end of the discourse. The funny thing about Thrasymachus is he shows up and he just right out the gate just says, no, this is nothing but Socrates manipulating everyone. And in fact, actually, the just is what isn't in the interest of the powerful. So he starts off in exactly the place that, yeah. you know, the current setup for, or the current treatment of discourse is sort of alleging. But the funny thing is what he concludes with, or rather not what he concludes so much, but where his story concludes is actually with just further dialogue. The amazing thing was he was not actually closed off to dialogue, as is evinced by the fact that the dialogue continues. It's not just yeah. like, you know, you get through that part of book one and then we're done. You know, just put it, the guy says, I won't debate. And then you just put the book down, right? No, there's a long book still to go, which is to say, laudably, even Thrasymachus, who kind of went down infamously in the history of philosophy as the guy who's against debate, still has discourse for the rest of the first couple of books of the mm-hmm. Apology or yeah. of the Republic.
Yeah. And if I could go back to the question, what is that underlying ideology that has so distorted mm-hmm. our perception of the good, so that things that are clearly evil are perceived as good by some people within our society? And I think we've been addressing that here in our comments, but so I want to go back to something that you said, JT. I think that at one of the ideologies right at the foundation of this distortion is nominalism and voluntarism, mm-hmm. right? This rejection of the idea that there is a natural essence, that there's something that it means to be a human, mm-hmm. right? And what's happened in our day is we've redefined essence as something like psychological subjectivity, right? We determine our essence based upon the psychological state that we have in our individual mind. And in our society, that psychological state ultimately and almost always gets identified in a sexual way. So what happens is our sexual identity becomes our essential identity. Yeah. Now, if you couple that with the notion that somebody already mentioned, this idea that speech is hate and that hate is violence and therefore disagreement is hate and disagreement mm-hmm. is violence. If you're someone like Charlie Kirk and you are speaking against a certain kind of lifestyle or a certain kind of sexual identity, if you're buying into this notion that what you are fundamentally is a matter of your own personal psychological subjectivity, and you are identifying in your very being your identity equals your sexuality, then when someone like Kirk comes along and he challenges the idea that a man could become a woman or a woman could become a man, for you, if you're buying into this ideology, he's now challenging your very being, right?
Yep,
your very
right.
essence mm-hmm. is now existentially threatened. Right. So you can see how there is kind of this indirect link between a society that takes on board a nominalism and a voluntarism and that eliminates the notion of a shared human essence. And how you go from there, it's just kind of a short jump to this notion of hate speech as violence. And if hate speech is really violence, if what Charlie Kirk is really doing when he's out there countering these ideologies, if he's actually doing violence to people who have these sexual identities, then all of a sudden you have a permission structure to return violence for violence, right? You just set up the ideological conditions for violence. So I think one of these ideological, I guess, conditions for these distorted perceptions of the good would be onboarding a nominalism and voluntarism.
Can I add another one though to build on what you're saying?
Sure.
Because I don't think there's any getting around. It's even almost a trope at this point for a conservative to come out and say, it's Marx, you know. But
a trope nominalism?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, again,
well played.
It's Marx. It's actually Marx. Because the thing is, like, the term false consciousness is sort of emerges. Actually, I think it's Friedrich Engels that coins it. But still, the point is, JT, you were mentioning like that there's sort of been this illusion of the public square.
Hmm.
And the first real place that is particularly isolated, held aloft, and then problematized is in this sort of Marxist discourse, wherein what's being problematized is essentially that if you partake in the public square, there's sort of a purchase fee, if you will, to get in, right? And so you have to already have agreed to have the debates and the discussions on the terms of the oppressors, that kind of thing. Right. And so false consciousness ends up being, you know, you can think of generally speaking, in economic terms, you're part of the lower class and you've already bought all the lies that the upper class have been selling you about how this system benefits everyone. And then you start pointing out how it's not benefiting you. And then it just gets weaponized against you because you've already bought all the premises that they need to then weaponize the discourse against you. And so the point is, what's so seductive about that way of thinking is I think we can all see that there's a kind of truth to that, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe not in the precise sense that Marx is going to be highlighting, maybe even in the precise sense. I'm trying not to make a judgment yet on this point. But the point is that we can always see in the conservative discourse, the current public square, I guess you could say, to the degree that it exists, in a sense, what you're pointing to is the fact that conservative ideas have already been excluded from the public square. And so part of the failing of it is that we can't even get our ideas to be heard, for crying out loud. And so there is a kind of exclusion. We're not willing to pay the fee to get into the public square to be able to have that discourse because we know, well, the words like woman have been dissolved and, well, I can't have that conversation anymore. And so there's a certain sense in which, false consciousness and whatnot played a devastating role to the removal of any kind of actual discourse in the public square. Maybe it unmasked that the public square was never never unbiased in the first place. That's a perfectly reasonable conversation to have going forward. But I do still want to go back to the point of discourse offering an olive branch. At the very least, it doesn't undo that, right? That's not necessarily the case on this point, right? But anyway, there's one other point I wanted to bring up.
But there's kind of an incoherence there because you just brought to my mind something you said before, which was one way that the left excuses itself from having to dialogue about their ideas is simply by labeling the other side as inhuman, right?
Yeah.
But for somebody to be inhuman, for somebody not to qualify as a human, doesn't there have to be such a thing as a human? Doesn't there have to be a human essence that has a telos, that has a purpose and conditions for flourishing? I mean,
actually, perhaps not. given what Drew just said, because as Drew was talking about the public square and the price to be paid, it actually explained the notion of deplatforming. Well, we don't want to give him a platform because they haven't paid the ideological price to be valued. So combining that with this nominalism, you go, if you don't pay that price, you're not one of us, and we are people, and you are not. Going back to this notion of tribalism, I mean, for many tribes around the globe, the name for that tribe is the same name for person. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not in that tribe, you are not a person. And if there's a tribalism ideologically on the left, then somebody who espouses ideas that are radically opposed to that ideological tribe are, in some practical sense, non-human to them.
I see.
To build a step or go a step further on that, the assertion of something like universal human nature is itself going to be problematized precisely on the grounds of some kind of cynicism. You can think of, for example, Frantz Fanon is going to be making the point that it's going to be a colonized identity always, you know, enforced upon somebody whose identity doesn't properly fit that, you know, white colonizer's notion of what it is to be a universal human. Right. And so, again, like the false consciousness here would be that your sense of the human, your understanding of the human is never actually achieving this universality, but rather that it is always getting stuck within a particular legislated idea of what it is to be human by the powers that be. So the colonizers or whiteness or whatever. Right. And so that's, you know, even go back to the Marxist identity, right? Like your idea of what it is to be a good human would be, you know, the bourgeois identity that they say is what everybody must live up to, which the proletariat cannot live up to. And therefore the proletariat is justly oppressed because they're not, you know, bougie enough, right? But the point is the appeal to, you know, universal identity is itself going to be problematized. And this itself is a strangely, you know, I mean, it's literally the claim is going to be that you're a racist, that you're, you know, a homophobe, that you're a sexist or whatever, right? For doing this. And in fact, I guarantee you there would be a leftist response to this would be something along the lines of, you know, look at these three white guys basically trying to say that everybody should conform to their white idea of what humanity is, something along those lines. And that Charlie Kirk was actually trying to force people to reason in like a white way or something like that. Right. Yeah. There's going to be something like that as the response. And that leaves us in a really difficult situation. You know, I mean, if we buy that, right, if we buy that line of reasoning, because at that point, it kind of legislates philosophically tribalism at the base, right? Now, which tribe is the grounding tribe? Nobody knows, right? Marx is going to assert that it's class distinction. You know, you're going to go to somebody like Frantz Fanon, and it's going to be like the colonizer distinction. You're going to go to like the LGBTQ+. It's going to be like, you know, heteronormativity or cis heteronormativity, something like that, versus everybody in the, you know, really in the plus community. Right. Yeah. You can see this same discourse over and over and over again. It's going to be whiteness versus non-white. You know, it's going to be Western versus or Occidental versus Oriental. You know, you can just see whichever one of these discourses it is. It's the same point over and over and over again. And so to assert some kind of universality is therefore to be guilty of asserting some sort of supremacy. So you can't get out of it that way. But then the problem of falling back to a kind of tribal discourse, well, how is that going to be reconciled? And the point is, there's no answer, and none has been really proposed other than, hey, let's just let those people on the periphery, let's let the non-whites, let's let the colonized, not the colonizers, let's let the LGBTQ+, not the white cis heteropatriarchal, you know, like whatever, right? You know, it's always let the ones who've been on the periphery move to the center now, and let the ones who are in the center be pushed to the periphery.
It seems like the one paradigm that kind of survives through all of these identities is the oppressed oppressor dichotomy.
Yeah. The Communist Manifesto in the end of chapter one, where it gives like the history, he ultimately says everything blurs down into that oppressed distinction. And so the real question is, which one of you is going to be the most oppressed? And the funny thing about this is, and I think this is a pretty important point in terms of this kind of discourse, is that oppression therefore becomes the status of your legitimization within the discourse, your right to the discourse. Yeah. But the funny thing is, it also means that oppression is actually going to be part of a political discourse as a term. So what I mean here is, don't think of oppression now in terms of like somebody's actually being oppressed, right? Think of it in terms of like a status that is afforded to somebody in a conversation. Mm-hmm. And to that degree, I think it's pretty safe to say that you will only ever be as oppressed as your political utility allows you to be. And to that degree, basically, you can see the discourse sort of constantly shifting in kind of humorous ways. Think of Dave Chappelle had a really great stand up a few years ago where he was like, look, it used to be, you know, that it was the black community that could claim to be the most oppressed. And now all of a sudden, you know, he has this line where he's saying, we had him on the ropes. We had Whitey on the ropes. I've only had one enemy my entire life, and we had Whitey on the ropes. And then they went and changed genders on us. And now we're in trouble again. And so the point being there, though, that you can see that the real power struggle is over who's going to be the most oppressed, who's going to be the most pushed to the periphery, because that simultaneously affords political merit and in a kind of backwards way.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, that's a real quagmire, Andrew. 5 minutes here. What, can you work us out of this?
No.
I kind of came to the same place. I'm like, this seems irreparable at some point. But again, it's only irreparable on a human to human, man oriented political spectrum. When revival comes, it means that the creator is making direct contact with his creation in some spirit to spirit or spirit to soul way. And just like Paul, we can see people who have the scales falling from their eyes. I grieve over the loss of a rich academic tradition, you know, that most of us have been tethered to and has a continuity over the last several thousand years in the West. Because as you know, teachers or academics, we go, well, what is a teacher without students? What's the use of a teacher without students? And yet, if the revival comes and is successful on a scale that previous revivals have been on, or proportionate or larger, then teachers in the church have the impetus to help those people that are coming out of the world for the first time to renew their mind.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah. Getting on here, I just have to say this, getting on and talking with guys who say things like, you know, I was rereading the Apology the other day, or I was contemplating Thrasymachus in the first few books of Plato's Republic. It's just, it's a delight to me just to hang out refreshing. With some fellow nerds.
Yeah. Let me just say that, you know, for all the postmodern talk about, you know, these structures of intelligibility that we build, these oppositions, these identity groups, this tribalism. At the end of the day, I think the hope, kind of the gesture to what you were saying, JT, is when at the end of the day, you have a bunch of individual people, right? You don't have you have this being of reason, which is the ideology. But beneath that being of reason, there is a ontologically basic person. And that person, as much as they want to deny things that they know to be true in the extramental reality, as much as they want to do that, it's impossible to do, you know, for the person living individually in this world. And so I think part of the, and I don't know if that makes any sense to you guys, it makes great sense to me, but
yeah.
Part of the solution here is it's not like we have to go tackle this entire worldview, which is internally consistent and coherent but it's person to person. You know, when you talk to the person on the street, they don't believe everything is a conventional construct for the means of power and political control. They do believe that there is a real world out there that we can be intellectually in contact with, including a moral aspect to that world. So reality is always a contact point. When you deal with the individual, right? When you deal with the individual person, apart from these grand schema that's created by the mind of man. And the other point that I want to say, and maybe end on this, to bring it back to Socrates, is, you know, the point you made about revival, JT, and about the divine kind of breaking in through all the confusion and through all of these conceptual monuments that we create, through all these beings of reason. I love that phrase. Makes so much sense out of the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, the divine has a way of just cutting through that like soft butter, like a hot knife through soft butter, right? Revival can just get straight to the heart. And to bring it back to Socrates, there's a really funny passage in First Alcibiades, which may or may not have been written by Plato. But anyway, the main character in First Alcibiades is Socrates, and he's talking to Alcibiades. And at one point in that dialogue, Socrates says, look, in order to be good, in order to know the truth about the good, you've got to have a teacher. You've got to have someone who teaches you the truth about the good. And I think this is actually meant for like comedic relief in this dialogue, because then Alcibiades goes, well, it's a good thing I have you, Socrates. And then he goes, but wait a minute, who taught you? And Socrates goes, oh, the God. God taught me.
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which this even comes out in the Apology, in some of the other dialogues, where how does Athens get someone like Socrates? How does a society so given to polytheism and sophistry, which kind of ruled the day, how do you have a breaking in of a Socrates, which leads to a Plato and an Aristotle? And so on, which I think ultimately sets the stage for the coming of Christ in some way. So the answer, at least from Plato's perspective, is you have divine intervention, right? The God plucked this person, Socrates, and gave him this mission to go to open the eyes of the Athenians. And Socrates even had his own daimon, right? His own spirit. Almost like a Holy Spirit that prevented him from doing or saying certain things and kind of guided him throughout his life. So just to bring it back, you know, Andrew, it's a very dark picture when you start to talk about the postmodern thought, the Marxist thought. It's like, how in the world do we address that? And I think your instincts, JT, are exactly right. It's none of this is troubling for God. You know, he can break in and cause revival and you may have taken a lifetime to construct your intellectual castle, but in an instant, God can bring those walls down. And I think that we're seeing this happen as kind of the fallout from this terrible tragedy with Charlie Kirk. And if you've been watching, especially if you watched that memorial service, I would say, guys, that the more people have probably heard the gospel, the true gospel, the call to repentance, not just some politicized gospel, but a genuine call to repentance. I think more people have heard the gospel in the last 2 weeks than perhaps in the last 20 years, if not more than that. So anyway, I think that's a good positive way to steer the conversation towards the end here. Any final words, JT or Andrew?
I wanted to go back to something that kind of combining what you've been saying, Anthony, and Drew's point about discord as an olive branch. I just lost my train of thought. Made my meta comment and didn't make my comment. that's what it was. It's this, that as we're dialoguing with someone, you know, and this is Jill Stone's sort of classical philosophy of education. What we're offering them is the truth that we think we have in us, right? And if they there was a movie in the 90s. I'm dating myself. There was a movie in the 90s called Reality Bites, and that's kind of the to Drew's point in that when we enter into dialogue, it doesn't have to be a will to power where I'm going to put my boot on your neck. And one of the ways that can motivate that is say, look, I'm going to offer you the truth that I think I have in me. You offer me the truth that you think you have in, and let's look at reality to see which of those is more reasonable, probable, because the consequence of, and I think the left is starting to feel this, the consequence of constantly rejecting reality itself is that at some point there's going to be reality's revenge. Reality is going to bite you.
Reality, like, has a way of breaking in, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And so and so that can be the motivation for fruitful discord, is to keep reality at the forefront and go, okay, let's have our dialogue over this shared common objective reality.
Good. Andrew, any parting thoughts here?
Not any that are hopeful. So I'm a pessimist.
It comes from reading all that enlightenment and post-enlightenment literature.
Well, and I got a lot of pessimist literature too that I find convincing. But
too much Nietzsche.
I don't really have any hopeful comments to end on. So maybe I shouldn't. But do appreciate it. It's been edifying having this conversation with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a hopeful conversation. I mean, as long as
until
Drew, you know what, JT? Next time we're not going to even invite Drew.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, thanks so much. This has been tons of fun.